everybody.
Hi, Dr. Nick.
Don't you be the doctor. You report the symptoms. I will determine their significance.
Mr. Evil.
Dr. Evil. I didn't spend 6 years in evil medical school to be called Mr. Thank you very much.
If they are, you know, doing some sort of medical thing to you, you want to be in the smallest room that they have, I think. You don't want to be in the largest room that they have. You know what I mean? You ever see these operating theaters that they have with, like, stadium seating? You don't want them doing anything to you that makes other doctors go, I have to see this. Are you kidding? Are they going to really do that to him? Are there seats? Can we get in? Do they scalp tickets to these things?
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case of loving you.
Well, here we are on a Wednesday afternoon. The odd snowflake swirling around, and that may be the case for the afternoon commute. We'll keep you right up to date on traffic and weather throughout the course of the afternoon. I'm Rob Snow. This is the Afternoon Edition, and we're starting things off with the healthiest hour on radio. Dr. Barry Dworkin is back taking your health-related phone calls. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, or 1-800-580-CFRA. There are the phone numbers to call. And while we wait for some phone calls, I think we've got a very interesting topic to discuss today. Because after a long and successful run as a brand name drug, a statin, Lipitor is available as a generic drug starting today. And at least in the United States, it's probably similar in Canada. This is the best-selling brand name prescription drug.
Pretty much, I would say, given that heart disease and diabetes are fairly common, it's a very common medication to use to reduce the risk of heart disease.
What does it do?
What it is, the fancy term, I like to use the real term, it's called an HMG-CoA reductase inhibitor. What that simply
rolls
means—
rolls right off the tongue.
That's right. What that simply means is that it targets a specific enzyme in the liver that converts precursors, molecules, to cholesterol. So it blocks the production of cholesterol, and it targets it specifically, which is what's interesting about the medication. Very little in terms of side effects. There are some reports occasionally of muscle aches and pains and such, but nevertheless, very safe medication to use in terms of benefit versus risk. And it is used specifically to lower cholesterol levels down to a level that research has demonstrated reduces your risk of heart disease. And in certain cases, if you lower, for example, the what we call the bad cholesterol or the LDL cholesterol below a certain level, the research has indicated that you sometimes get a reversal of the deposition of the plaques that build up in coronary arteries, increasing the diameter and ability of blood to flow through it to reduce the risk of heart disease and heart attack. It's used a lot in diabetics, as even if your cholesterols are reasonable, when you're diabetic, you have an automatic doubling of your risk of heart disease.
Wow.
And so when you do the calculations for heart disease risk, these individuals end up with recommendations to use a statin to reduce that risk.
Now that it will be available in generic form, how does that change the game? How does that impact medical practice for a drug that, let's face it, it is very popular.
Right. Well, in the United States,
it's a gold standard, right? For this.
Yeah. In the United States, it has gone generic. In Canada, it has been generic for a little bit of time.
Okay.
The issue becomes efficacy of the medications. And I've been on record stating that I find that there are some generic medications that do not perform as well as the brand name. And I've given my reasons, being that in the production of a medication, generic medications only have to show what's called bioavailability. That is, when you take a blood test in literally 20 individuals, you test their blood to see if the medication is present in the bloodstream. What it doesn't tell you is how efficacious or how well it works. And people will say, well, they're the same molecule. Not necessarily. What you have to consider is when medication is developed, there's also the delivery system and the binders that actually provide the medication at a certain rate. But you also have, let's say, for example, Rob, whenever you make a chemical compound, especially with regards to in medications, you will get two versions of the same compound. a left-sided one and a right-sided one, literally mirror images of them. And these are called isomers. And you'll have and usually you'll see sometimes in the chemical name, it'll say D or L with regards to the beginning of the medication. And that'll tell you what side it is, a right-sided one or a left-sided one. When you think about each compound in three dimensions, it's like a lock and a key. And if you have a mirror image of a key, it normally won't fit into the lock that you've just created. So it doesn't bind to the receptor properly. Mm. And so you don't get the same activity. When the medications that were originally developed and sold under a brand name, they're tested for a specific way that they were produced. So say for every 10 molecules, say let's use Lipitor as an example. For every 10 molecules that are produced of this, 7 are the left-sided version and 3 are the right-sided version. And that's what is tested and shown to be efficacious. But when you have a generic medication, you don't necessarily get that. You can get 3 of the left-sided and 7 of the right-sided, and you don't get the same efficacy. And that's what we see a lot with regards to psychotropic medications or antidepressants. Again, I can only provide experience from discussion with other physicians and with my own practice. So I have to mention that. That's the qualifier. But nevertheless, I have had many patients who have been stable on their medications for years, presenting with months of deterioration. And when inquiry is made, their brand name was switched, or even their generic medication was switched to a different branded generic medication. And that's the only difference that has happened in their lives. And when you put them back on a medication they were on before, in terms of matching it up, their
you
brand
see
name,
improvement.
They improve. Yeah. The same thing happens for proton pump inhibitors, which are medications used to treat ulcers or gastroesophageal reflux disease or acid reflux. There are again, patients that will come in to say, you know, the one I was using before, even though I'm getting the generic now, the one I was using before worked much better than what I'm taking right now. And you reverse it and they get better. Now, the qualifier is that for some people, the generics will work well, but for others, they do not. And the implication is that those that are already on something that is working, right, be it generic or brand name, don't fix what isn't broken. And what is happening is that a lot of people are getting things fixed that isn't broken because insurance companies are switching them over to the generics, assuming that everything is okay.
Because of cost.
Yeah. Because of cost.
You will continue to prescribe Lipitor. You would not prescribe the generic.
I don't like using generics per se. And again, the qualifier is I am not paid by any company. I don't get money from any drug company. I don't support any drug companies. I don't do talks for any drug companies. I have no financial implications with any drug manufacturer. So that's the qualifier. And I will use the brand name because that has been tested.
Rigorously tested.
It has gone through an approval process. And as well, when you consider interactions between medications, the interactions information is based on the brand name use and not on the generic use. And again, there are generic medications that will work very well. There are antibiotics that work very well. There are other medications that work fine. But if I have somebody that I need to treat and I need to use something that I know has been tested a certain way and produced a certain result.
It was the top-selling drug in the United States last year with sales, Lipitor, $7.2 billion. Wow.
Yeah. But there's, again, top causes of death in our society is heart disease, stroke, diabetes, you know, all those things. And that's why that medication is prescribed.
Okay. Phil in Ottawa, you're up first with Dr. Dworkin. Go ahead, sir.
Yes. Hi, doctor.
Hi.
My question is about sinus and sinus infection.
Mm-hmm.
About a year ago, 2 years going back, I kept getting, you know, sinus infections, colds. Basically, it starts as a cold and then just develops to sinus infection. I went to my doctor and there was x-rays that were done, and he said that I had a sinus cyst on one side.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I was told to, you know, keep taking the nasal sprays.
right.
that I take. I have seasonal allergies, basically. That's mainly what you know, gets a lot of that going on. So it didn't help. Basically, I would have, you know, blocked nostrils. I have congestion and all that, and all these numerous sinus infections that would have to have antibiotics to get rid of it. And then basically I went to a specialist, and after I saw the specialist, and he gave me a requisition to go get a CT scan, I started to get better. For some reason, the past 8-9 months, I haven't even caught a cold.
Okay.
So, mind you, at that time I was working really hard, two jobs and so on. So I don't know if that made an effect. But now I'm feeling good, and when I had the appointment to go do my CT scan, I was researching online, and I see, you know, saying that there's risk for cancer from CT scan, that it increases. It's like an X-ray times 100, you know. So I actually ended up canceling my appointment, especially because I felt good. So what is your view on what all this has been, you know, what has been happening? Is it, you know, your view on why I've had these episodes for 2 years and then now I'm better, and also what your view is on CT scan, and why do you think that specialist recommended a CT scan?
Well, the CT scan was recommended because they wanted to get a better image of the sinus. An X-ray in and of itself doesn't really show the dimensions of the cyst. It doesn't show where it's extending because it's a two-dimensional picture that tends to have a lot of shadows. And so what the CT scan would accomplish is not only looking at the sinuses, but also the nasal cavity to look for any anatomical deformities, anything that may be blocking the sinus. So it was a means of trying to establish that information. You're correct in that there's X-rays that are used when using a CT. And yes, indeed, they're much more exposure than a chest X-ray. What one has to keep in mind, though, is that radiation, in terms of the damage that it does, is more cumulative in nature. So if someone is having one CT scan, yes, over the course of one's life, it may increase the risk of certain changes to tissues, potentially cancerous, but that risk is extremely low because it's a one-time exposure. People get a lot of it. People, for example, if someone is flying from here to London in the UK, they're getting radiation exposure more than chest X-rays, in fact, multiple chest X-rays every time they fly across and travel. So one has to keep in mind that radiation is as part of our environment as well, and that we are unaware at times that we're exposed. But over our lifetimes, our exposure may be the same as having that one CT scan. So that's sort of the issue with regards to CTs. They are very helpful. Obviously, you don't do a test unless it's trying to establish or help you establish a diagnosis or help in terms of changing a treatment or management. So you don't do these things just for the sake of doing them. And it likely was ordered as a means of trying to establish what was going on with regards to the illness. Now, with what's happened over the past couple of years and then it resolving, what you're pointing out is extremely important because it illustrates a factor with regards to what we call the natural history of diseases. We tend to sometimes experience illnesses that will wax and wane over time. There is a term that we call regression towards the mean. All that simply implicates is that there's an average way we feel. And in terms of a disease process, let's take an example, pain from osteoarthritis. There are days or weeks or months where it gets really bad and the pain is terrible. And there are other days where you wake up and go, hey, you know, this is really, it's not too bad today. I'm feeling all right. And you really haven't done anything different in terms of what you've been doing with your life. It's the disease has a natural cycle to it. It may get worse over time, but that cycle does persist. And you do get times where things settle down and you get sometimes regression of the disease. And what tends to happen is that people will use remedies or use things at the peak of when things hurt or when things or the symptoms are bad, but things would get better anyway. And there's a false association made with using something and getting better. And in your situation, it may be that you're now not exposed as much to the allergens. You've changed your work. You're not working two jobs. You may not be exposed to the pathogens and allergens that made things worse. And your body, too, may have found over time that the allergic response is not as severe anymore and tends to have resolved. So my overall comment on this is that if you're feeling well now, testing things will not make things any better if you're feeling better. And if it recurs, then you can certainly go through the process again. But right now, if you're feeling better, I would just leave things alone.
Okay. We have to stop here.
I worked in the operating room, and doctors make mistakes like anybody else. You know, I'm not knocking them. They make mistakes. Now, what would a doctor say if he makes a mistake? You know, like especially in surgery, when a guy's operating. Now, you know, a mechanic will mess up something. He says, oops, you know, that kind of thing. What's a doctor say when he cuts the wrong thing? You know, the guy's operating, and it's local anesthesia. You know, the guy's just awake down there reading a magazine or something. And, you know, they're operating on against strobers, sheets. Grabs it, string it aside, shakes, oops. And the patient said, what did you say? Nothing, just lying down. What did you say? Did you say oops? Oh, boy, I've said oops before. I know what I've done when I've said oops. Now, what did you do saying oops there? You know, that kind of thing.
Okay, 342 580 CFRA.
I remember I was a surgeon that I was in my training, and this came up. He said, we don't say oops. We go, if you're doing something and something happens, he goes, you just say there.
Dr. Dworkin's here. It's the Wednesday House Call, 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility or 1-800-580-CFRA. Frank, thanks for holding. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Hi. Oh, got an explosive question here. The employees have been trained, I would say, to use the hand sanitizer, you know, when they come in, since the flu, anyway. But another question popped up now with this mess with the doctor there looking up the bowel.
Right.
You know, apparently, they can get HIV and
very rarely, though.
Yeah, but they always said that, like, especially Hep C was transmitted by blood. And on the hand sanitizer, it says 99.9% of germs. Can you? I haven't heard that germs before.
Mm-hmm.
But how effective is it against, let's say, Hep C? Suppose somebody is using your bathroom and makes the odd sandwich for other people and plays around with the roast.
Hepatitis C is not transmitted in the way that, for example, hepatitis B is. When you look at the actual ratio or odds of getting hepatitis C compared to, say, we say just use one as your no risk. So the number one is no risk. And so double risk would be two, odds ratio, we'd call that odds ratio being 2, 3, 4. So when you look at the actual risk of contracting hepatitis C, intravenous drug use has a ratio of almost 50 to 1. So 50 times more likely to get hepatitis C through intravenous drug use than just walking down the street and meeting people. That's sort of the risk. Blood transfusions is about 11. Having sex with an intravenous drug user is 6. And being struck or cut with a bloody object, about 2. And piercing your ears or body parts, also a ratio of about 2. So you can see the difference in terms of actual risk with regards to hepatitis C. So in terms of contracting hepatitis C from someone who's preparing food, not very likely. Hepatitis A, yes. Hepatitis A is transmitted through waterborne or poor sanitation, and hepatitis A can be transmitted from person to person through contaminating food or water. Hepatitis B, very contagious, found in all body fluids, can, for example, is in sweat, is in tears, is in blood, is
saliva
right. Everywhere. Most common, in fact, what's interesting is that the most common transmission for hepatitis B when traveling is not sexual activity, it's actually sporting activity. because when people get into sports, especially rougher sports,
right.
they can get cut or bruised, and there's a lot of sweating, and you can transmit infections that way.
I think about being in the Dominican recently, people playing volleyball, for example.
Yeah, and so those are the ways that the disease gets transmitted.
You can get a vaccination for Hep A and Hep B, though, right?
Absolutely. You have Hep A and Hep B vaccines combined or separate, depending
on the Twinrix vaccinations. Yeah, and, I see those advertised all the
time. So there are ways to prevent that infection. But the hepatitis C, frankly, you know, in as much as now they're doing the testing, you have to keep in mind that in our general population, you have people who have Hep C, and you cannot prove there's no cause and effect right now with regards to exposure.
Okay. Leo.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead with Dr. Dworkin, sir.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a problem. I sweat a lot, like from head to toe. And basically, it's like just sweating. And like that, I don't sleep. Because I toss and turn, and I sleep with a towel, and still, I don't know what to think.
Are you overweight, sir?
No.
No.
I'm about 5'7", 165.
Well, what you have is called hyperhidrosis, which simply means excessive sweating. And is it all over, or is it...
All over.
It is all over, right?
Yeah, from head to toe. All my hair turns all wet, my whole body, even my toes.
Well, usually there are variations. Unfortunately, you're at the other end of the spectrum with regards to sweating. It doesn't necessarily denote a disease process, especially if you've had this for a long time. Has this been something you've had for quite some time?
At least 15 years.
Yeah. So usually there isn't a disease process that's doing this. So we have to then deal with what triggers the sweating. And that is usually there is part of your nervous system that will cause you to sweat.
Anxiety.
And anxiety can do that as well. But it's just the actual nerve response that you have that can cause sweating to occur more often than not. And so some of the therapies that have been used are beta blockers, for example. These are medications that were originally used to treat high blood pressure and continue to be.
I don't have high blood pressure.
Right. But in low doses, it can also shut down the sweating reflex.
That
might be helpful to reduce things. Hmm. Other things there are, things like antiperspirants, but in a prescription form that you can use, especially for areas of your body that sweat a lot, that may help reduce it. But really, you're faced with treating the symptom because the underlying condition is unlikely to be determined. And so it is a matter of then blocking that nerve response to try and at least reduce. It's not going to be perfect, but at least reduce that. So I'd speak to your physician about potentially trying a beta blocker if it's not contraindicated for you. And to see if that helps, but at least it's a starting point.
Judy in Almont, you're up next with Dr. Dworkin. Judy, go ahead.
Hello, I have a question about diabetes.
Yes.
I'm new to it. I was diagnosed in September. They called me in because my blood sugar was 19.
Mm-hmm.
And it's now under pretty good control. I range anywhere from 5 to 9, occasionally a 10. But something strange is happening occasionally as well. I'll measure my blood sugar 2 hours after supper, and the other day it was 7, and I had nothing else except water, ice water, throughout the evening. In the morning, my blood sugar was 9.
Mm-hmm.
So how can it increase overnight if I haven't eaten anything?
The reason is that overnight your liver is producing sugar, and so you can get sugar released into your bloodstream that way. The fancy term for that is called gluconeogenesis. Gluco refers to sugar. Neo means new and genesis means birth. And so it's just new sugar that is being produced by the liver in overall metabolism. And so it's very common sometimes to see blood sugars increase over the nighttime. And so it's still a matter of when measuring sugars, I would imagine you've been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes.
That's correct.
And so in this case, although monitoring blood sugar might be helpful for many patients, in fact, there is quite a bit of evidence to show that although measuring it gives you sort of a day-to-day difference, it's not really that relevant. In fact, the reason being is that unlike someone who, for example, is taking insulin that has to know their blood sugars immediately in order to adjust the insulin dose to bring the sugars down, type 2 diabetics don't have these huge sugar swings where you then change your oral medication. So it's not a matter of one day I'm going to take this amount of milligrams of my medication. In this case, it could be metformin. And then the next day I'm going to change it again. Usually what we do is we take a measurement over a three-month time, and it's a measurement called a glycosylated hemoglobin, or what we call hemoglobin A1C. And what this particular measurement looks at is the percentage of red blood cells that have sugar molecules attached to them, or glucose molecules attached to them. The normal reading is between 4 to 6%. And because red blood cells live for 120 days before they're replaced, it gives you a good indication of how the sugar has been controlled over that time. So if someone has, and if you have that done and it says, you know, your A1C is 6.5%, okay, that's a little bit elevated, but it tells us that for the most part, the sugars are reasonably controlled. Mm-hmm. And then when you do this 3 months later, and if it goes from 6.5 down to 6.3, it means that over that past 3 months, your sugars are even better controlled. So taking blood sugars, it's good for the first little bit of time just to see where things are at. But usually every 3 months for type 2 diabetics is a reasonable approach, especially at that point you can adjust medications.
Okay.
But in terms of blood sugars, the other thing to keep in mind is that for many people where type 2 diabetes is reflective of sometimes too much weight gain, mm-hmm. that you can completely reverse your diabetes by losing the weight and get rid of your medications. I've had several patients over this past month where I've had the absolute, I'm telling you, it's the absolute pleasure telling someone you can stop all of your medications because you've reversed your diabetes.
That's what I'm hoping for. Yeah. It's been 30 pounds so far, and
that's
going well.
That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And if you keep doing that, I can guarantee you you'll need to use less and less of the medications, and not only that, improve your quality of life.
Thank you. You've given me a lot of good information.
You're very welcome.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
That's it. Out of time.
All
and
right.
I apologize to the callers that we left on the air. You're more than welcome to call on Sunday. Dr. Dworkin is back on Sunday, 4 o'clock with the Sunday House Call. Don't forget health headlines every morning during Maidley in the Morning. And thanks again for this
My
week.
My pleasure.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.